the trifecta they had in Minnesota because of the kind of outrage that engendered among Minnesota voters, particularly, you know, any liberal-leaning voters. And that was one of the first bills that he signed, was a codification of abortion rights in Minnesota. And he went out of his way to kind of advertise Minnesota as a sanctuary for people around the country who needed to get abortions but were maybe unable to in their states. He said, you know, you can come here and you will not be prosecuted. We won't work with surrounding states. And obviously the Democrats are very much hoping that that issue is going to propel the party to another victory in 2024. Trump and the Republicans have had to moderate on it, realizing that this is a massive political liability. Healthcare as well. It's another one of the major cost concerns that Americans feel. I mean, it's been that way for years, but consistently in poll after poll and survey after survey, Americans say that their healthcare bills, their medical bills that they get, are one of their biggest concerns. Now, the thing that I think that Harris and Walz need to do is actually, beyond just using their own personal histories and kind of framing this in very empathetic language to try and connect with voters, I think they need to offer them real solutions on this stuff. You know, I think something like codifying Roe v. Wade on a national level, that seems like a no-brainer. But I think they also need to present an actual healthcare plan beyond just kind of vague platitudes or simply talking about strengthening the Affordable Care Act. You know, there has to be something done to really make sure that the people are able to get the healthcare they need, that they're not going to be worried about going bankrupt. And I think unless people are given these concrete solutions to the concerns around affordability in their lives, which have been sky high since 2021. You know, I think that you can make all the kind of savvy VP picks that you want and all the good speeches, but ultimately it's not going to get people wanting to go out and stand in line and vote for you in November.
Bracco, we only have about a minute. I wanted to ask you, in terms of the conventional wisdom of many Democrats saying that that Kamala Harris choosing Walz instead of Josh Shapiro from a key swing state like Pennsylvania, or Mark Kelly from Arizona, would not add that much to the ticket. What's your sense of that?
I think that's not true. I mean, I think Shapiro was a very risky pick if he had been chosen, not just because of his stance in Israel-Palestine, but because of a number of scandals that were in his background. And the fact that he, in terms of his business friendliness, is wanting to cut corporate tax rates, it was completely out of step with both Harris and where a lot of the American public is. I think there has been a sea change in the American political landscape. It was his record for all the flaws that there are to his record, and believe me, there are definitely many flaws. It's still a very robust progressive record, and in the past that would have been considered a liability. But I think, according to reports, at least, you know, one of the big reasons that Harris chose Walz, one of the things that she saw in him as a viable governing partner, was the fact that he was someone who had done a lot of the things that she wants to do on a national level, and she thought that he could help her do that. And by the way, the things that she wants to do, the things that she's talking about, the things that Walz has already done in Minnesota, if you look at surveys, they're overwhelmingly popular among the American public across partisan lines. So I think, you know, that has been true for a long time, but it's taken a long time for the Democratic Party, for the kind of establishment in Washington to realize it. And so we're seeing these things start to really change before our eyes now.
For more on where the new Democratic vice presidential candidate and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz stands on Israel-Gaza and pro-Palestinian protests, we're joined now by Asma Mohammed, campaign manager for Vote Uncommitted Minnesota. She's the co-chair of the Minnesota Uncommitted Delegation, one of the 11 Minnesota Uncommitted Delegates going to the Democratic National Convention. Asma, welcome to Democracy Now! You're usually in Minnesota, but joining us today from Chicago. What are your governor's positions as you come from Minnesota and he is the governor of Minnesota?
Yeah, Governor Walz has been pretty clear in his support for Israel in the past, and we know that. In the past, he has refused to meet with Palestinian families who want to talk about Gaza. He has refused to divest from Israeli bonds and banks, and we know that. And at the same time, we know that the decision ultimately relies with Kamala Harris. So we don't necessarily want to meet with him, but we do want to meet with the vice president because she's shown a willingness to learn and to move. And we know that Tim Walz has obviously done a little bit of the same. Right. He has moved in the NRA. He had an A rating with the NRA, and now he has an F rating with them. So he has shown a willingness to listen to the people. So we are hopeful there. But in the past, he has definitely been a pro-Israel in his governorship.
And Asma, you're one of the 11 Minnesota uncommitted delegates who will be going to the Democratic National Convention. What will you be calling for there?
So as one of the 11 delegates coming from Minnesota, uncommitted, we are pushing for Harris delegates that want a ceasefire to join us in calling for a ceasefire and an arms embargo against Israel. And we want a meeting with Vice President Harris so we can talk to her to get a commitment for an arms embargo and a ceasefire. Because we know right now, going into November, that we cannot win this election without the nearly 1 million voters who voted alongside us during the primaries. During the primaries, 46,000 Minnesotans voted saying that they wanted the war in Gaza to stop. Right. And we know that those people may not even show up to the polls in November. They have no reason to show up if there is no ceasefire and no arms embargo by November. And we want to remind Vice President Harris of that. So we are asking for a meeting at the DNC with her and uncommitted delegates.
Asma Mohammed, I know there's been a demand by the uncommitted movement, uncommitted delegates who are going to be in Chicago at the DNC, for Dr. Tania Haj Hassan to be able to speak from the stage, one of the many American doctors who have volunteered in Gaza. Is that still a demand? And if you can also talk about what are the plans for the Democratic National Convention?
Absolutely. So Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, again, is a doctor who went to Gaza and got to see the atrocities firsthand. We just want 5 minutes of her on stage at the DNC to share what she saw with the people at the convention, to share with delegates that they have power to push for a ceasefire and that without an arms embargo, a ceasefire doesn't matter because those are U.S. weapons that we continue to supply. So I think our ask is very clear. We want people to hear from a doctor who has really no political agenda beyond telling people what she witnessed. And then beyond that, we want Harris delegates because, believe it or not, there are Harris delegates who really do support a ceasefire. 80% of Democrats support a ceasefire. And we want to remind the party and the party leadership of that. So we've put an ask out to Jamie Harrison, the chair of the DNC. We've put an ask out to the DNC, and we think that they are amenable to these demands. And we think we are hopeful that we are going to hear back from the vice president on this.
And Asma, it's hard to say, but what do you feel do you feel that the uncommitted movement had an impact on Kamala Harris and her choice of Tim Walz as a running mate?
I think that the uncommitted movement absolutely had an impact on Kamala Harris choosing Tim Walz because, first things first, we have the largest uncommitted delegation in the country, and Tim Walz had nice things to say about the uncommitted delegation. He pointed out that we were sharing our voices and that our voices should be heard by the candidate. At that time, he had no idea whether or not he had no idea that he would ever be considered for a VP because at that time, President Biden was still in the running. And so I think that was a part of it. And the other thing I think that's really important is that Shapiro wasn't kind to protesters. He wasn't kind. He really wasn't supportive of anyone that was talking about Gaza. He had his own, I think, scandals beyond that. And more than anything, I think Tim Walz was like a non-controversial pick. But I do think that we had an influence. And I think that the choice of Walz was made in good faith to show young voters, Muslim voters, people that were really feeling that they were not being heard by the Harris campaign, that here, look, this is for you. It, I think, was a gift for a lot of people that were feeling like, if it's Shapiro, I'm out. I'm done with this campaign. And because of the Walz pick, are feeling a little bit more energized. And I don't think that's the same for everyone, especially for people from Minnesota who have felt, you know, the impact of his pro-Israel policies, or felt the impact of the being the National Guard being called in 2020, or on Line 3 protesters. But I still think that it felt like a non-controversial pick, and is a reminder that Kamala Harris is different.
Asma Mohammed, we want to thank you for being with us, campaign manager for Vote Uncommitted Minnesota. And we want to thank Branko Marcetic, Jacobin staff writer. His new piece headlined, "The Tim Walz VP Pick Shows America's Politics Are Changing." Next up, we go to Jeremy Scahill with Drop Site News about his new report, "Something Came from the Outside, an Eyewitness Account of the Aftermath of Ismail Haniyeh's Assassination." Stay with us. Patti Smith. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how the Middle East is bracing for a possible broader regional war after Hamas's top political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, was assassinated in Tehran, and a top Hezbollah commander was assassinated in Beirut last week. Israel took credit for the Beirut strike and has been widely accused of being behind the Haniyeh killing. On Tuesday, Hamas named Yahya Sinwar to be the group's new political leader, replacing Haniyeh. Yahya Sinwar has served as Hamas's top leader in Gaza since 2017, is credited with being the mastermind of the October 7th attack on Israel that killed more than 1,100 people. For more on boiling tensions in the region, we go to Croatia, where we are joined by Jeremy Scahill of Drop Site News. His recent piece is headlined, "Something Came from the Outside, an Eyewitness Account of the Aftermath of Ismail Haniyeh's Assassination." Jeremy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you start off by finding out who you spoke to and what you found out?
Well, Amy, first, let's set the scene here. Benjamin Netanyahu, the week before these assassinations, had celebrated his victory tour in the United States, where he not only stood before the U.S. Congress and got repeated standing ovations as though he was on some sort of a bloody, bizarro version, you know, world version of a concert where he was celebrating his genocidal war and receiving generous applause from both Democrats and Republicans. And he not only met with the sitting president, but also Kamala Harris, as well as Donald Trump. And the message that he heard from all three of them was that they were ironclad in their support for what they characterized as Israel's security. Now, there was some difference in how each of those three people interacted with Netanyahu, but the most important thing for people to remember is that all three of them firmly support the bipartisan U.S. policy, which has led to this genocidal scorched earth war against the Palestinians of Gaza. So Netanyahu then comes back to Israel on, and immediately immediately greenlights a series of assassinations. You have the killing in Beirut of Fouad Shakur, who was a senior Hezbollah commander, also killed in that strike, we understand, was an Iranian military advisor to Hezbollah. And that was followed just some hours later by the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas's political bureau. And Haniyeh had just returned back to a guest residence that is housed within a compound in northern Tehran that is controlled and guarded by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the most elite military force in the country. I spoke to Dr. Khaled Kadoumi, who is Hamas's senior representative in Tehran and also a member of its Arab and Muslim world outreach division of Hamas. He was on the second floor of this building. You know, they call it a guest house, but it's basically like an apartment complex. And Dr. Kadoumi was on the second floor. Ismail Haniyeh and his bodyguard were on the fourth floor. Dr. Kadoumi described to me how he had not gone to the state dinner, which was held in honor of Iran inaugurating its new president. Ismail Haniyeh was there, as were many leaders from the region. Haniyeh gets back to the guest complex around 11:30. Dr. Kadoumi and others gather with Haniyeh. He says that they were discussing the assassination of Fouad Shakur in Lebanon and what they were assessing might be the regional implications for a broader war and Netanyahu's game plan. And then they retired to their rooms to go to sleep. And Dr. Kadoumi described hearing a massive shaking of the building. And he, you know, was disoriented, woke up, didn't know what it was. He thought at first maybe there had been an earthquake on what he said was a kind of great scale. He gets out of the bedroom and just sees smoke. He discovers that the bathroom walls and part of the ceiling had collapsed in the room where he was. He goes out into the hallway. Other members of the Hamas delegation told them that there had been some sort of a strike on Ismail Haniyeh's apartment. Dr. Kadoumi, who is a medical doctor, ran then up to the fourth floor, and he entered the guest suite where Ismail Haniyeh had been staying, and he discovered the body of Ismail Haniyeh as well as his bodyguard. And he described to me seeing what appeared to be a massive hole in the exterior wall. It also had some windows, but he said it appeared to him as though some sort of a missile or other projectile had crashed into the room from the outside, and that was what had in fact killed Ismail Haniyeh.
And Jeremy, what do you make of the New York Times report that came out a few days later claiming that the explosion was a result of a bomb that had been smuggled into that residence months earlier? And of course, that report was from Ronan Bergman, who is the New York Times reporter probably most closest to Israeli intelligence.
Yeah, Juan, that's correct. You know, Israel has been clearly spinning a narrative. In fact, today, some of the top Israeli propagandists on social media have been pushing more details about this story. And they say that that Mossad was able to co-opt Iranians to go into the guest complex and plant these explosives. And they say that the perpetrators of the bombing of Haniyeh were captured on CCTV. And, you know, Ronan Bergman was the first to report this in the New York Times, and he has a very long history of reporting on Mossad activities. He has close ties to Israeli intelligence. He wrote a book called Rise and Kill First, which is about the history of Israel's assassination program. And really, this narrative is something that is sort of like pulled from the script pages of the series Tehran, the Israeli show about a covert Israeli agent who is operating inside of Iran, trying to take down a nuclear reactor. Now, I should say, in the interest of accuracy and fairness, we don't know exactly what happened there. It is plausible that what is being promoted by the New York Times and you know, Israeli propagandists is largely the truth, that they were able to penetrate the building, that they planted these explosives. The Iranians, though, have pushed back very, very strongly against that. They say that some sort of a projectile hit the building. In fact, Juan, within hours of the explosion inside of Haniyeh's guest suite, Iranian news services were already saying that some sort of a projectile was seen hitting the building. So it's, you know, it's possible that what is being stated about a bomb being planted there is true. The Iranians are pushing back against it. Not just Dr. Kadoumi from Hamas, but other eyewitnesses also described damage to the scene that appears consistent with a missile or a rocket or some sort of projectile hitting it. There's been discussion that Israeli intelligence was able to penetrate either the mobile phone of Ismail Haniyeh or his bodyguard, and that they were able to use tracking malware to pinpoint a precision missile strike against him. There have been reports that Ismail Haniyeh's entire upper body was destroyed, which, you know, could either be consistent with a bomb under a bed that exploded or a missile directly hitting him if he was near his phone. So we don't know. What we do know is that the Iranians are in a position to release forensic evidence, presumably in an IRGC compound. They also have video surveillance capabilities. We know that they did have counter-espionage facilities there, as well as radar and presumably counter-missile technology in the area. So either way you slice it, though, this is very bad for Iran, because it indicates a security breach. Yes, it would probably be worse if they were able to penetrate the ranks of the IRGC and convert Iranians into agents. But the mere fact that Israel was able to do this assassination on Iranian soil is a very, very bad thing for Iran. And that lends some legitimacy to the fact that they're saying that it was, you know, a missile strike, because even admitting that is very, very bad. But at the end of the day, the Iranians are in the best position to present evidence to the world of what happened. I must say, though, that while this discussion is relevant, how did Israel assassinate the leader of Hamas, the top negotiator, in a process that Joe Biden is claiming is so central that he wants a ceasefire right now? Every time we talk about this, or what the Israelis have succeeded in doing, is distracting from the fact that the genocide in Gaza continues, that Netanyahu is serving as the chief arsonist in the Middle East, that he's trying to draw the United States into war with Iran, that he's trying to draw the United States into war with Hezbollah. And, you know, for all the talk of Western countries about how Iran needs to show restraint, the truth is, and this is just a fact, it's not politically correct to say it, but it's factual, both Iran and Hezbollah, given what they've been facing, have already shown quite a bit of restraint. And the last time the Iranians responded to the Israelis was when Israel, on April 1st, launched a strike inside of Syria, in Damascus. They bombed the Iranian consulate. They killed a dozen people. About half of them were IRGC personnel. Yes, Iran rained missiles down on Israel and sent, you know, fleets of drones toward Israel, but they did it in a highly telegraphed manner that allowed the United States and other countries to amass a very effective counter-missile defense operation. I believe one person was killed in that Iranian missile strike. So, you know, the devil is often in the details here. It's very clear that Netanyahu has no intention of engaging in a ceasefire. He's going to continue with the genocide in Gaza. And he really wanted to strike not just at Hamas, but in many ways, this was a very bold operation to tell Iran, we can strike whenever and wherever we want against you.
We just have less than a minute, Jeremy, but your response to the latest news that Hamas has chosen Yahya Sinwar to replace Ismail Haniyeh, of course, who was assassinated and was the chief negotiator with Israel around the issue of a ceasefire.
My sources, Amy, have told me, within Hamas, have told me that this was a wartime decision, that they didn't have time to assemble the full Shura Council, and that the only sensible decision they could make was to fully support the on-the-ground commander of the military operations, which right now is Yahya Sinwar. This is also in line with recent polls that have done in the Palestinian occupied territories that indicate that the popularity of Sinwar and Hamas in general are rising as the popularity of Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority are going down. It's a statement that they understand Israel wants to fight to quote unquote total victory, and they're going to continue their operations, which they feel have been successful militarily in repelling and causing great harm to the Israeli military.
Jeremy Scaho, we want to thank you so much for being with us of Drop Site News. We'll link to your recent piece headlined, Something Came from the Outside, an eyewitness account of the aftermath of Ismail Haniyeh's assassination. Jeremy is former senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today with some very sad news. Today we remember our dear colleague, Samin Farhande. She was the Democracy Now! Education Director for the last 13 years. She died on Monday after a battle with colon cancer. Samin was an award-winning independent producer, lifelong educator and activist. She's survived by her partner of 20 years, Eric Hiltner, and their daughter, Ana Luisa Minu Farhande. We're going to go now to a clip of Samin speaking at the Allied Radio Conference in Detroit before the pandemic about her work at Democracy Now!
We have a broadcast from 8 to 9 live in New York City each day, each weekday. And my job is to do outreach to the education community, to colleges, high schools, middle schools, even elementary. And we have, at this time, over 1,000 students that come through our studio. So what we do is I talk to the teachers or professors. They will bring their students. So let's say a professor of philosophy or ethics or media studies or a high school that is studying journalism or government. Or an English class, a middle school, they will bring their students early in the morning at 7:30. They will we show them our control room. We show them all the crew that's working, the producers, video producers, line producers, technical director, behind the scenes, and then we show them the studio as well. Then they sit down at 8. The show starts, and they watch in our green room. They watch the show both from what's going on to the air and also what is happening in the studio. So they see Amy Goodman, they see Juan Gonzalez, and they see the show guests. They watch the show, and after the show, we have a discussion about the show content and really try to demystify and deconstruct how media is made. And also, we talk about the issues, you know. So we talk about how is Democracy Now!, this independent media program, this news program, different from corporate media? How is it different from, say, CNN or ABC News and so forth?
When the pandemic hit in 2020, rather than closing up shop because Samin would shepherd classes through, conduct wide-ranging discussions with fourth graders, with graduate students in journalism, with journalists from other countries who'd come through the United States. But she simply expanded to doing Zoom calls with classes around the world, reaching thousands of students. Samin has been a longtime documentary filmmaker. She was a part of a group from Deep Dish TV and Paper Tiger TV that produced a series back in 1990 and 1991 before the Gulf War started called the Gulf Crisis TV Project. This is Samin in one of those videos.
This series is made out of material sent to us by people all over the country who are currently speaking out against the U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf. Nationwide, people are raising questions, demanding information, organizing teach-ins, and finding out that they are a part of a major movement focused on peace in the Persian Gulf and the need to solve domestic problems.
Samin is survived by her partner of 20 years, Eric Hiltner, and her daughter, Ana Luisa Minu Farhande, who graduated from Beacon High School just a few weeks ago and now heads to Sarah Lawrence College. Ana Luisa, we will all be there for you now and forever. I used to take long walks with Samin and our little pups, Zazu and Ziggy, through the Lower East Side. She particularly would take me to the gardens that she had fought so hard for, the community gardens of the Lower East Side, of which there are more than 100. Samin will be so sorely missed here at Democracy Now!, but her legacy will inspire so many. Our deepest condolences to Ana Luisa, to Eric, to her dearest friends and community, which is so large, which is global. Samin taught at Hampshire College, at the School of Visual Arts, as her work appeared at the Whitney and so many other places. Samin, your life has had so much meaning and will continue to. Samin, Minu, Luisa, Farhande, presente. That does it for our show. We thank everyone for being there for Samin and for Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Listening to